Thanks for listening to The Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook, / The Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter, at The Kick-Ass Life, and of course, at thekickasslife.com.
Hi, this is Marcy Shymoff, and you're listening to David Wood on the fabulous Kick-Ass Life Show.
Want to make your life better?
This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Well, hello. Oh dear, I'm in a silly mood today. Not sure why. If the truth be known, I have a tad little bit of a hangover from yesterday. Just a little one. It was the second bottle of wine, Your Honor. Promise. Well, maybe I should do the whole show in me Irish accent. Harry, me name's Patio Furniture. I do see now we're in 121 countries. So 121 countries. That sounds like a lot, doesn't it? 121 countries. Anyway, I don't know if you do accents or not. I tell you a funny story. My friend Jim Ross, if you guys are from Calgary, I know there's a lot of people in Alberta who listen in. He lives in a small town called High River. So you can go and substantiate this story. Go and knock on his door and say, Mr. Ross, I want to know whether this is true or not. Anyway, he had a radio show, and it was like one of these like really boring. He's a good friend of mine, so I can say this. But, you know, it was like a real estate show. And, like, you know, Jim has like, he's got this kind of duality of a personality. You know, he's either completely crazy out there, wacky, or he's really kind of like, you know, Mr. Serious Business. And he's very, very successful. Very, very successful. Anyway, at the time, he was the president of the real estate board for Alberta, I think it was. And he's got this radio show. Anyway, we'd been out one night, and we'd stayed up really, really, really late. And I know he wasn't feeling too good. But I do all these accents. You know, I tell a lot of jokes, and I love telling jokes, and I love using accents. So I thought I'd phone into his radio show. And in fact, I've thought about doing it on my own. I've thought about having your own radio show. Imagine being all your own guests. That would be so much fun. Anyway, so I phone up, and I phone him as a Chinese guy, I phone as an East Indian, I phone with all these different accents. And of course, he kind of knows it's me, but it's a live show. He can't do anything about it. He can't, once he knows, you know. And his name's Jim Ross. And I remember I phoned one time and I said, oh, yes, I'm wanting to speak to Mr. Jim Rutt, please. And he said, no, it's Ross. Yes, Mr. Rutt. I want to tell you, I've been listening to your show for so long and it is completely changing my life. Anyway, I have a lot of East Indian friends and they don't mind me doing the accents. They don't get all weird on me because I can do an accent. I can do British accents and I am from Britain as well. You know, it doesn't really quite matter, does it? But anyway, so, and my Chinese accent, I got him again, you know, the same thing. But, you know, when I started to lay on these compliments, and this has to be, it's got to be 10 years ago. And of course now I'm laying it on thicker and thicker about how he's changed my life. And of course he can't get out of this thing. And I phone him back. And of course, I mean, it's a real estate show. How many people are phoning in? And I just kept phoning till I got through. So the name Mr. Rutt, even today, 10 years later, every time I see him, oh, good afternoon, Mr. Rutt. Here he is. So anyway, so if you don't do an accent, I think it's this week is the week to practice. You got to practice an accent. They're so much fun to do. And I make so many crank calls and I always, always seem to get away with them. And people have said to me, you'll never get me. But in the right circumstances, if you know a certain amount of things, then you can always get one. In fact, Jim, again, the same guy, Mr. Rutt, I had a bet with him about that one time that I could get his girlfriend to go out with me on a date. On the night that she'd planned a date with him. And this is, again, true story. You could go track him down. So I pretended to be Australian. And so I said, you just got to give me three or four pieces of information that not many people would know. That's all I need to do the crank call. And in fact, we should do some on this show. Wouldn't it be funny to listen to some crank calls? I mean, I should record some. It would be so hilarious. And I phoned this girl and I pretended, I said, "Hi, mate." I said, I can't remember her name now. I think it was Leslie. I said, "Oh, Leslie." I said, it's Paul from Melbourne. And she's like, "Sorry?" "Yeah, mate, it's Paul from Melbourne." And I start to do this thing, you know, and I said, "You remember?" I said, "I met you at such and such." And I had these four or five pieces of information, which really only someone who knew her could really know. Anyway, so I said, we met one night, we had a few drinks, and she said to call if I was ever in town. I start talking about Australia, and I really start just sort of getting into it with her by the end of the call. And he's sitting right next to me. And by the end of the call, I have my date. So listen, accents are the thing. But anyway, I will continue in the future with my accents, and we'll have a little fun. And again, if you get weird about it, don't. It's weird. It's just like, you know, there's not a prejudiced bone in my body. But I mean, it's just fun, right? We like to have fun. And talking about fun, the guy that I got on the show this week is a serious amount of fun. And, you know, but he had a thing happen to him. You know, I don't know if you followed the Bernie Madoff case. Now, Bernie Madoff did the biggest white-collar crime, I think, in history, the history of the world. I mean, we're talking about billions of dollars over decades. He stole, and this guy was the chief of the NASDAQ at one point. And I mean, we're talking about billions of dollars, and he financed this ridiculous lifestyle he had. But he stole from colleges and universities and individuals and multimillionaires, and he had this web of people that, I mean, that were getting investors to invest with him. And my guest this week was one of those people. Him and his wife lost everything. Imagine losing everything. And they're, you know, getting on in age. I mean, he's not a young kitten anymore, you know, and losing everything and getting that call. And when you hear the story of where he got the call, it really fascinates me where he got the call. And his wife is very, very famous now, because after that, after losing everything, they had to sort of really reel in their life. I don't want to give it away, but his wife, Jeanine Roth, she wrote a book after this incident called Women, these are new lips, I'm just breaking them in, Food and God, Women, Food and God, and Oprah had her on, I think it was 35 weeks on the New York Times number one bestseller list. I mean, it was like this thing, you know, and this story of, you know, being ripped off by this guy of everything they had, and rebuilding, and his wife, again, coming out with his book, which has really completely changed both their lives. But this guy is all about fun, and he calls himself the nation's foremost authority on the use of fun, humor, and team building. And he calls himself, he says, he's the founder and emperor, that's so typically him, of Playfair. It's an international consulting firm based in Northern California, and you know, he's been elected to the Professional Speakers Hall of Fame, and that's for the first time I met him. He was on stage, and we've become friends since, and we're actually going to be working together in a few weeks here in Whistler, in Canada. And he's been honored by Successful Meetings Magazine as one of the 25 top speakers of the 21st century. Which is pretty awesome. He really is that guy. But he's written some books, including Managing to Have Fun, Gently Down the Stream, Work Like Your Dog, and Dogs Don't Bite When a Growl Will Do. There are four of his books, but just this great guy. So listen in as we have a chat. And again, this was a really fascinating case for me, this whole Madoff thing. I followed it intently because I'm really interested in human nature. And the fact that he could pull this off, this crime was so massive and affected so, I mean, people committed suicide after this thing. So this is a big deal. Anyway, listen in as Matt and I have a great chat. I've been looking forward to this call for so long, this podcast, this training, whatever we call it, this sort of look into life. And my guest is someone that has a sparkle that I think everyone who meets wants to have, wants to own. So I want to say hello and welcome to my guest today, Matt. Hey, Matt, are you there?
I am indeed.
How are you?
Hey, David, doing great.
Yeah. You know, when I first heard you train, speak, share, you shared a story that really resonated with me. But what really resonated with me was what you do for a living. You know, you call yourself the founder and emperor of a company called Playfair, which we'll talk about in a bit. So somebody who really uses fun in a very unique way to break down barriers, to expand the way we see the world, to create, you know, a greater way of learning. I mean, just you use fun in this magical way. And so with anyone who does that, there's always tests. Tests to see how we move through things. Tests that will, you know, shake the foundation of whether, you know, what we teach really is grounded in something deeper. And you had this remarkable experience that tested you and your wonderful wife, Janine, in such a unique way. And I wonder if you can take me back to where you were in the world, because I know that was extraordinary. And this moment, and you've probably shared this 1,000 times already, but you know, I just want the people who don't know your story to get that sense of what was going on.
Yeah, well, it started when a group of my college roommates, who I've still stayed close with over the years, decided they were going to Australia. I'm not in Australia. Well, that was one stop along the way. But they actually were going to Antarctica. And they tried to enroll me in going, and I was like, Antarctica? You know, that is about the last place on Earth I want to go. Why would I go to Antarctica? And they just kept giving me the sales job. And finally they said to me, wait a minute, aren't you the guy who wrote the book Work Like Your Dog, about you should take every opportunity to have fun in your life, and here are some of your close friends. They're going to have fun. They're going to Antarctica. You got to come with us. So finally I broke down, and I went with them to Antarctica. And it was a spectacular trip. I mean, I can't recommend it, actually, enthusiastically enough. We were in places where the whole trip, we never saw anybody else except the people on our little ship. And we would just step out into just virgin wilderness and amazing ice. And, you know, you see fantastic wildlife down there and icebergs, like floating works of art, and just an amazing trip. And so about halfway through, I got a page to go up to the bridge for a satellite phone call. And I thought I knew what it was. I had been working with a speakers bureau on a whole big series of dates that we were going to do with a client. And they said, look, if this thing comes through, we have to be able to know how to get in touch with you. And I said, you know, we're going to be sailing on 3 different oceans. But I gave them kind of ways to catch up with me. And so I actually went running up the stairs to the bridge, because I knew these satellite phone calls cost $10 a minute. And, you know, I didn't want to waste anybody's money. When I picked up the phone, it was not the speakers bureau. It was, in fact, my wife, Janine. And she said a couple of words that just turned me completely pale. She said, Bernie Madoff's been arrested. His entire fund is a complete scam. And what she didn't have to say out loud, but what both of us knew in that moment, was that we had just lost our entire life savings. And, you know, I'm pretty sure that most of your listeners know about the Bernie Madoff thing, but in case they don't, he ran the biggest Ponzi scheme in history, you know, totally dwarfed anything like Enron or WorldCom. And in the end, he wound up stealing $65 billion. Not all of which was mine, however, but every penny that I had, he took, along with a lot more. So, you know, Janine and I were just devastated. I mean, we didn't know whether we could pay our mortgage. We didn't know if we could stay in our house. We didn't have any contingency plan. We had been in there for over 10 years. We had so many friends who were invested with Madoff. My closest friend who had gotten us into it, he had been in there since the 80s, and his father, who worked in the same office with Madoff, had been invested with Madoff since the 70s. So this had an incredible track record. I mean, we had no doubts in our mind that this was okay. And so, you know, Janine and I just kind of reassured each other and talked for a couple of minutes, and then one of us finally had the sense to say to the other one, you know what, honey, we are no longer the kind of people who can afford to talk on the satellite telephone at $10 a minute? So we just had to hang up. And I'll tell you what was amazing that day. I was, of course, completely shattered and just walking around the boat. And two of my one of my college roommates and his partner wrote a wonderful book called How We Choose to Be Happy. Their names are Rick Foster and Greg Hicks. And they had given seminars based on their book, on the happiness work, on every single continent except for Antarctica. And so that night they were giving a seminar on happiness. And of course they wanted me to come down and assist and be there with them. And I was able to last about 15 minutes in there before going up and saying, I'm so sorry, guys. I just can't be present in this moment. I just can't do this. And, you know, as you might imagine, it was a huge, huge loss and a complete disorientation in my life. And what was worse was, you know, everywhere I've been in the world, if something difficult happened, I could get home. But this was Antarctica. They weren't about to turn the ship around for me. We were totally isolated. There was no input, no radio, no phone, nothing for another 8 days. So when we finally got back to Argentina and, you know, I went on the internet, I couldn't believe how big this thing was. Because, you know, there was a very small circle of us who knew about Bernie Madoff. And all of a sudden, he was on the news. The whole world knew about it. And even we didn't know that he had so many investors. We thought it was kind of a small little club. I mean, we knew all of our friends who were in there, which was probably about 30 people. But we didn't get the scope of it all, that there was tens of thousands of people who were involved.
I want to ask a question about Bernie, because this is something I was fascinated with. You know, I love the human mind. I love watching all types of people. You know, it fascinates me how Hitler and Gandhi had the same kind of effect on people, except one was really good, one was really bad. But Bernie Madoff, to pull off a scam, which they calculate goes back to the 70s, that this Ponzi scheme actually started in the 70s. They believe that he was illegitimate the whole time, yet he became the chairman of NASDAQ. And I want to know, did you actually meet him in your dealings with him, or what kind of sense did you have about this guy himself? I know he was very secretive. I know getting to know him, he put a lot of deals together on the golf course and his exclusive clubs and things like that. So he kept everything kind of, that's why you believe there was only a number of you, because he kept everything kind of under the radar, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, he was investigated by the SEC several times and totally cleared. So, you know, we would hear reports like, oh, something's going on, and oh, no, everything's fine. So he managed to just intimidate and pull the wool over the eyes of all the authorities. And, yeah, he had a legitimate business in addition to this business. And his legitimate business was part of the brokerage world. At one time, almost 10% of all the trades on the New York Stock Exchange ran through his organization. So he had a big legitimate side to it. It's just that this side, which had its own separate floor in his building, was totally invented and illegitimate and you know, a bogus Ponzi scheme. I never met him personally, but I could have. I mean, one of my friends who was in the fund, his son was going to New York and he wanted to go on Wall Street, and so they just sent him in to talk to Bernie. I mean, you know, I could have seen him, but I didn't. I never saw any need to meet him personally.
Well, when you have everything invested with this type of situation, you're in Antarctica, I wonder, you know, and then you start hearing these stories. You're in Argentina, you have this, go on the internet, you suddenly realize that he's ripped off, you know, college funds and little old ladies who are not young enough necessarily to bounce back, you know, people losing their homes, and yourself looking at your own life saying, hey, can we afford to live here anymore? Can we afford to manage this lifestyle that we have anymore? Are you angry? Are you numb? What's those reactions, those human reactions that you're going through, especially being so isolated where you know, there's really, you can't do anything about it. I mean, what went on for you personally deep inside?
Yeah, I was, you know, I have to tell you, anger was a brief flare in there, because this guy was obviously a psychopath. It was more, there was a lot of shame, because I knew you have to diversify your investments. This thing seemed so safe. This thing had such a track record. It was just so easy that, both Janine and I realized we weren't taking responsibility for stewardship of our own money. You know, we both were really interested. We loved our work. She's a writer and writes about the emotional reasons why women use food and kind of using the compulsion with food and any compulsion as actually not a curse, as a doorway into a spiritual awakening. Her last name is Janine Roth. And I love my work so much. So both of us were blessed in that we did work that we loved. We made money at it pretty effortlessly. But then once we had the money, we didn't pay any attention to it. We used Madoff like a bank. So mostly I felt despair. And I felt a lot of shame. I mean, it was clearly my fault. I mean, yeah, Madoff was an evil, insane person. But I don't know. I never got into it was his fault. He didn't recruit me. I came to him and said, take my money and invest it. But, you know, the beautiful thing was I had a lot of my close friends were in this, because my friend Richard would see people who were struggling, and kind of as a gift, he would say, I'm a part of this fund, I'm going to get you into it, and it'll really help, you know, stabilize your finances. And so he unwittingly got, I don't know how many people, probably 40 or 50 people into this thing. And I remember going for a walk with one of my friends, and he also was all in Madoff. Almost all of us were all in, and people were worse off than me. Some people mortgaged their homes because they could make more money with Madoff, and they just, I mean, that was.
Matt, just to give it context for people that don't know, his returns over all those years were about what, 10% or something like that? I don't remember exactly.
Yeah,
but.
You know, in the boom years in the 80s and 90s, where people were making 20-25% on their money, Madoff was still making 10-12%, 8-12%, but it was constant. In the down times, you were making the same thing. In the up times, you were making less than anybody else, but you're making the same thing. So I think he only had one down quarter in all the 10 years we were with him. So he was pretty consistently positive. It wasn't grandiose, you're going to make a fortune, but it was, you know, that's why so many people put their retirement funds in there, because it was a consistent growth. You know, I don't think we ever made less than 5% a year with him. But we never made the big returns that some other people were making, but we didn't need to.
But that was the selling feature in many ways, the strategy of bringing in friends and family like he did, people telling, like Richard. I'm really fascinated by your friend Richard. You know, he's got 40 or 50 of his closest friends or associates, people he knew that he was trying to help. What did he go through in this whole thing where suddenly he sees all of the people he cares about, their life savings gone? Devastation in many ways, because some people committed suicide through this. They lost everything and took their own lives. I mean, this was a horrendous moment in kind of human history of somebody, like you say, a sociopath who just does this really awful thing to people. What did Richard go through, and were you able to help him, and did people turn on him at all in your group? Did everyone understand? What did he go through?
Well, you know, there was mixed. Some people did turn on him. Mostly people were there for him, and mostly people saw that he, with the best of intentions, had led people down a difficult path. But his heart was very pure. He just totally did this. And he himself was incredibly generous. He was on the board of foundations. I mean, he made a lot of money through Madoff, but he gave a lot of it away and took care of people. So he's a good guy. And he was just put in this unbelievable position of, you know, the world really crumbled onto him because he thought he knew so much about how to help people, and the whole time he was just spewing lies. And, you know, the thing about Madoff, it was very hard to understand his strategy, which was kind of described as an arbitrage strategy. Richard, I think, actually thought he understood it. But in the end, of course, no one understood it because it wasn't the truth. So, you know, of course, he felt devastated. But, you know, we had a – this happened the end of – this happened this December 11th, the day Madoff turned himself in. And we had a New Year's Eve party. I had been back about a week for a number of the people who had lost everything in Madoff. And one of my friends – asked an amazing question. He said, if you had to do anything, you know, if you could do it all over again, would you do anything differently? And the first two people who spoke up totally blew my mind. Both of them said, I wouldn't change a thing. They said, the amount of spiritual growth, the amount of introspection, the amazing amount that I've learned and grown in these last 2 weeks, no amount of money could be traded for how expanded I feel inside myself right now. You know, and I thought to myself, whoa, I can't believe that they are saying this. You know, I mean, I agree that I feel like I've learned a lot, but, you know, I wouldn't mind having the money back at the same time. But, you know, I think that's what happened with most of the people in my inner circle. That was so amazing. It took me a little longer than them because they had, for one thing, they had a head start. They were all meeting together as soon as this happened, and I was kind of just isolated out on the boat. But within a very short period of time, I would say both Janine and I were as happy as we'd ever been.
I want to get to that in a second. I just want to ask one more question about Bernie, because I know that there's a huge turnaround in this story that really excites me. But Bernie gets 150 years in prison, the maximum that anyone could get. Did the world change that day? I mean, was it enough? I mean, when you look to the sort of the vindication, and again, I'm not a subscriber to that necessarily, but I'm fascinated by how you're all watching this day in court came. You know, he's living in his penthouse suite and sort of under house arrest, and you know, there's all these houses and this lifestyle that's being uncovered. The story's kind of being unfolded of what he's done. What again, the group of people you're in, and obviously everyone reacted differently. What did you feel vindicated? Did you feel like, you know, that was justice served in some way, or was that just, did you all just put it behind you quickly and just move into your life? What went on for you through that process?
Yeah, almost nobody I know cares about what happens to Madoff. Most people have just left him behind. And, you know, are we glad he's in prison? Of course. If anybody deserves to be in prison, he deserves to be in prison. But do I take any pleasure from reading about his daily life or hoping that he's suffering or anything? No. You know, I don't even know how to say this, but... it's like the less I think about that very, very sick individual, the less polluted my own life gets.
No, I get that. That's huge.
It's like you get hit by a tornado or something. He's a force of evil. He's a force of nature. But... it's not about a personal relationship with me and him. It's more about what I can do to change my own life from here on forward and what I can learn from it.
And that's a great transition now into what happened next. You know, you and Janine, you say you sort of discovered a depth and everything about your life was magnified in some ways, but there's a sort of a story that occurs now in your life. And I want you to take me through, if you can, the play-by-play of once you get back, you settle down, you have this party, you start to adjust, and you start to think, hey, you start to look at your financial life of whether you can continue on. And what happened? What happened in those months and that year and now since that allowed you, first of all, to to regain this beautiful essence between you and your wife, but then also to actually reclaim your financial health, which you got it all back and more, which I think is just this astounding story.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing is that people, we were called Madoff survivors, were on a little, internet chat room of our own, and you had to, like, show your bona fides. You had to show that you were ripped off by Madoff to be a part of this little club. And the stories that I read on there were so touching. It's just so amazing of, this woman who had to take her mother out of assisted living because she couldn't afford to pay for it anymore and move her back into a little room by herself, and her poor, mother just not understanding what was happening and just weeping and sobbing, and so many stories about people older than me who couldn't work anymore and in the worst possible economic climate were just forced into heartbreaking sacrifices. I mean, it was just painful.
How old were you at the time, you and your wife?
We were in our late 50s.
Okay, great.
Yeah, late 50s. And, we could still working, but people even, 5 and 10 years older than us who had retired already, they couldn't get back on their feet. It was so, so difficult. Even for people I knew that had, had dreams. One woman was just about to start up a company, and then she just didn't have the capital to do it anymore. And, I mean, just really something. But we could still work, and we still loved our work, and we had a passion for our work. So, yeah, we had nothing in the bank. I mean, I think I remember Janine got a check for $3,000 and something, and we opened a bank account, and we looked at each other, and we laughed, and we said, okay, here's our savings. We're starting up again. But we were able to stay afloat. And the other thing is, because we're both creative artists, we had kind of a flame about using and digesting what happened to us in the creative process. So I think that I started doing a talk and a performance piece called What Bernie Madoff Couldn't Steal From Me, and kind of about the whole experience of it. And this was while we were still broke. I started rehearsing it and started doing it, and I think, David, you've seen it. It's up on the TED website.
I saw it live, and I have watched it.
Oh, you saw it live? Yeah,
But I have watched it on TED as well, and also on YouTube, yeah. I think. And it's called it's Matt Weinstein, What Bernie Madoff Couldn't
Steal From Me. Yeah,
yeah.
So
it's awesome.
I actually got a lot of positive feedback on that. I think on TED it has about 130,000 views or something, and I actually got a group in Amsterdam who flew me over to talk about that. There was actually a group in Saskatoon, so I got to talk about it in Canada. And at the same time, Janine wrote a piece in Salon, the online magazine, about her experience with Madoff, and kind of about the same thing, about coming to peace with it and noticing that, especially as a woman, she kind of deferred responsibility about money and kind of her own awakening about being interested in money and finances. And that went kind of wild on the internet, that piece, and she got interviewed on the Today Show and the morning show on Fox, and eventually she actually wrote a book proposal about it, which is a book that just came out recently called Lost and Found, and kind of about writing in the moment, a journal of her, of when we lost everything and what was happening on the way back. And so while she, when that book was purchased, it actually gave us a little breathing room because she got a little advance on that book. And she finished up the book she had been working on for a couple of years, which was called Women, Food, and God. And so, you know, we both kind of continued moving forward and were... Difficult things like this can break couples apart. They really can. There can be recriminations. It can be, you know, I can't believe you did this. And for us, it had the opposite. It actually brought us closer, and we really had to cut down. Well, of course, you know, we had to be in pretty much austerity mode because we didn't have anything in the bank. And you know, I tell you what, for me too, because my livelihood is going out and talking to people about laughter, fun, play, and joy, I really had to look inside myself and say, I'm not going to go talking about this subject unless I can genuinely come from a place of modeling this with people in my own life and in my own soul when I'm talking about it. So I think it kind of hastened my own recovery to know that without joy in my life, I can't do my work. I can't teach on this subject. And so it took me a little while to get back in there. But, you know, it's not new with me, the idea that you don't need a lot of money to be happy, that joy is not dependent on the size of your bank account, that there are so many little things every day that are sources of joy and openness and love. And especially it's about having community and having connection. And what was lucky for me was I had so many close friends in the same boat. And we really met together pretty regularly. We took care of each other. One of my friends moved in with she was single and she moved in with a couple in their spare room. And it was just beautiful the way people reacted to the difficult situation by opening to each other.
I know it's a different kind of thing. I remember I was part of a flood one time. I lived in a small town where there was a massive flood. It was called High River, the name of the town. And just watching the whole community come together and fight, you know, we were evacuating people from homes and carrying furniture and emptying stores. And we worked all night, you know, and there was just this in the morning, everyone's exhausted as the river peaked. And I just remember laying there covered in mud and dirt and everyone's evacuated in the school. And I'm laying there and as I pass out, just thinking how beautiful the human spirit is. And I think sometimes these calamities just sort of amplify what's really good about humanity, right?
It's absolutely true.
I just want to, before I get into more what you're doing, because I find what you're doing so fascinating. And again, watching you in every moment, I love watching people when they don't think I'm watching, because I really love studying people. And, you know, and you have that wonderful spark, like I talked about in your sort of in the opening here. But, you know, I still want to sort of uncover a little bit about, you know, this idea that there are so many people in the scheme that got hurt that just didn't want to talk about it anymore. In fact, they were embarrassed. Like you talked about having shame in the beginning. Yeah. And yet, really, part of the recovery process was this bringing forth, even for you, it was a humorous way. And I'm sure the impact of the incident on your wife's writing, you talked about two books, Lost and Found, which has just come out. But this Woman, Food, and God was something she finished around that time. There was a point, I think she was on Oprah at one point, and it was that, I'm not clear on that detail, but there was this kind of like this massive turnaround financially. Was you surprised at the speed of the comeback? I mean, did it surprise you at all, or was it just something you didn't focus on again and you just kept focusing on bringing joy and having fun and doing the thing that you do all the time?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is we were happy to be working. We were happy to be kind of in a creative explosion. So it was it great that the money came back? Absolutely. Absolutely. Was it necessary? No, it really wasn't. It didn't change much for us at all, which was pretty amazing to see. But, you know, what happened was Women, Food, and God came out Janine was interviewed on Oprah Radio, and Oprah, I think, was driving home and just listening to it and said, okay. And then she, the next day the phone rang and it was Oprah herself, and she interviewed Janine for O Magazine, and immediately the first edition of the book sold out. And then Oprah flew her to Chicago, and they did 2 hours on the radio together. And then they Oprah devoted 2 separate complete shows to Women, Food, and God. There was one in May, and then there was one in July, I believe. And as a result, Women, Food, and God stayed on the New York Times bestseller list most of the time at number one for 36 weeks. And in the end of the year, it was the number one best-selling hardcover of the entire year for most of the year. And then in the last part of December, George Bush's autobiography caught it and passed it. So it turned out to be number two best-selling book for all of 2010. And so, you know, obviously, when you sell 1 million books, a lot of things happen. And we also got together a wonderful kind of online teaching for Janine, a Women, Food, and God online retreat that, that people signed up for on her website, which is JanineRoth.com. And
Can you spell Janine? Because I was trying to write it down.
Thinking, yeah.
There's about 11,000 different ways to spell it.
Right. It's G-E-N-E-E-N. G-E-N-E-E-N Roth, R-O-T-H. So, yeah, I'm glad you asked me that.
Yeah, yeah, G-E-N-E-E-N.
G-E-N-E-E-N-R-O-T-H.
Yeah, there you go.
.com.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, I don't know if your listeners are interested in this, but, you know, David, you and I are in a group together called the Transformational Leadership Council, and I did a, and it just was so fascinating to me how the little connections can happen. I did a program there, and one of the guys in the audience came up and said, you know, I'm doing a little benefit for all of my subscribers. Usually, this guy is named Alex Mandosian, and he teaches online marketing things. And he said, most of my stuff happens online, but once a year, I bring some of my students together, and as a gift, I give them a workshop. And he said, I'd love for you to come and speak to my people. So I came there and spoke to them and did a kind of playfulness community building event. It was really fun. And one of the guys in the audience was a guy I had met 20 years ago. And I said to him, Jay, what are you doing here? He said, oh, I'm one of Alex's top trainers. And he said, if you're ever interested in doing an online course, you know, I can help you with it. And so that's what we wound up doing. We wound up, with Jay's help, producing an online course for Janine about Women, Food, and God that was fantastically successful. And it's just funny how all these little things, one thing leads to another. Someone sees me, I do that. And that's what changed in terms of our financial prosperity.
Mm. You know, I call the show The Kick-Ass Life. And I wonder if I was to ask you now, having gone through this, where, you know, almost losing everything, and both you and your wife, you know, really focusing on the depth of what's really most important, and both of you coming out and just enjoying huge success, how would you define the kick-ass life? You know, what does that mean to you in this journey of yours?
You know, I just happened to hear over this weekend a guy talking about the concept of flow, and now this guy, I can't spell this guy's name, but flow was a concept that was coined by this guy named Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. But you just got, if you ever want to look up his book, you just look up FLOW. And it's kind of like that place in life, he said, that is between boredom and anxiety. In other words, you're pushing yourself enough so that you're not bored, you're not doing the same thing all the time, but you're not pushing yourself so far that you're outside your competence and you're really anxious that you're going to fail. In between those two is a place he called flow, and it's a place of ease and of naturalness and of joy and of success and of happiness. And that was the sweet spot that both of us fell into, but in spite of the financial pressures, we didn't do anything to make money, but we did kind of what our joy was. And I tell you, the pressure of having no money makes you come alive and helps you wake up every morning and helps you get out there and do things. And for me, because, you know, I started doing this piece, about what Bernie Madoff couldn't steal from me. As soon as I started feeling better, I realized I needed to express this artistically. And it was a fantastic catharsis for me. I just set up in friends' living rooms, you know, at first groups of 10 and 20 and 30 people, just doing it and getting feedback and polishing it and taking it on the road. It was so fun and also just so incredibly helping me deepen my own understanding to be working on a kind of theatrical presentation of this. So just using what happens in your life to move you forward and just being open to anything. I mean, of course you'd rather live a happy life with no bumps in the road, but I don't know anybody who gets to have that. I don't know anybody who gets to have that. And just realizing that pain is part of life as much as joy. And, you know, I'm attracted to joy and play and fun. It's what turns me on. It's what I want to teach to people. It's the space I want to be in. I'm never more alive than when I'm in front of people, giving them a transmission and helping them become alive. But that's not what life is all the time. But whatever it is, you can embrace it and take it. I mean, if someone had said to me before Madoff, hey, I think if you lose all your money, you're going to be a lot happier next year than you are right now, I would have said you're nuts. But I actually believe that happened.
Well,
we're not. It's when you get attached to what you think you need to make your life work, that's when you don't have that, you feel terrible. But if you're just open to, hey, it's a river, and I'm going this way, I'm going that way. I have a group of friends who, for the last 33 years, we've gone river rafting on the Rogue River up in Oregon, but in inner tubes. And you just learn from that you have to relax, and a wave is going to hit you in the face and knock you over backwards, and you'll be gasping and holding onto your tube. But, you know, where the river takes you is just like the rest of your life. Not quite so violent usually, but
you know, thank you for that. You know, I know that you are sort of inducted into the National Speakers Hall of Fame, and I think Successful Meetings Magazine called you one of the top 21 speakers of the 21st century, and I can see that, you know. But there's something you do. You call yourself the founder and emperor of Playfair, and you do this thing with colleges and universities and young people, and I wonder if you can share a little bit about that, because I know this is one of your core passions, and sort of talk about what that really is. What's Playfair, and what's this thing that you do around helping these kids at university and colleges?
Yeah, we've been actually doing that part of our business for 35 years now, and it's been incredibly successful. And we have some colleges that we've worked with their incoming freshman class every year for the last 30 years. There's about 25 trainers in the organization, and it's a very short season. It's pretty much the last 2 weeks in August and the first week in September. And we'll be at somewhere between 350 and 400 colleges and universities in the U.S. and Canada. And what we say to them is, give us your new student class the first day of school. And we will do a giant mixer, icebreaker, community building, playfulness event with them, where they'll play with each other, where they'll get to meet each other, where they'll get name and face recognition of each other, and where they'll feel like they belong. Because, you know, first day on campus is for many people their first time away from home. They have the question, did I make the right decision? Yeah, I was a big fish back in high school. Are people going to like me here? And the reason they drop out is not because the teachers aren't any good, because they're great professors everywhere. There are not enough books in the library. You got to be kidding me. It's because they feel like they don't fit in. They feel like nobody cares about them. And what we found is this technology of laughter, play, and fun is the language at play is a language that everybody speaks pretty fluently in childhood, but we don't get so much a chance to talk in an adult way playfully. So what we've invented is a lot of games that no one has ever seen before, a lot of really fun activities that people just, their innate joy is expressed, and in that place, everybody looks irresistible. So people bond right away. I mean, we get letters from people. I met my girlfriend at Playfair the first day of school, and now we're engaged, and we have people who come back as seniors. They met, as freshmen, and in the middle of the Playfair, the guy will say, "Can I have the microphone?" He'll get down on one knee. He'll propose to his girlfriend. I mean, it's unbelievable, the stuff that happens there. But it's a very powerful kind of initiation rite, saying, look, you're not in high school anymore. You're in a place where people care about you in a community where who you are is important, but where something much bigger than yourself is going on. And it's been a spectacular ride for us. It's so much fun. You know, I often say, people say to me, well, you know, you get a chance to work with big corporations like, you know, IBM and AT&T, and I know you worked with, why do you keep going back to the colleges and working with them? And I say, you know, the joy that happens with that college new student population, there have been times where at the end of the program, the students have rushed the stage and lifted me up on their shoulders and carried me around the room. That happens much less frequently, let's say, with IBM.
Oh, dude, I love it. Let me ask you a question. Is someone listening in? I mean, you know that I told you this when we chatted for a couple of minutes before we started the call. I keep calling it a call. I want to keep the show before we started the show. How does someone play in this? I mean, if someone's listening and they want to get involved in this at all, how would they do that? Is there a way that, I mean, are you expanding? Could you get more trainers? Could you do more countries? I mean, is this something that there's a bigger game here, or are you kind of tapped out already?
You know, that is a question that we keep asking ourselves. People who want to join our network, I ask them to go to our website. They can either go to playfair.com, PLAYFAIR.com, or, you know what, I actually have a new website that's really fun, because most organizations hire me to speak right after lunch, because you think that people go to lunch and they have food and fuel and they'll be all energized, but of course exactly the opposite happens. They come back from lunch and they feel like they need a nap, and so somebody comes up and is talking to them and everybody's kind of in a daze. But my stuff is so interactive that it wakes people up right away. So I just got this new URL called theafterlunchguy.com. And if you go to theafterlunchguy.com, you'll see a bunch of our videos there as well. If you go to playfair.com, there's our corporate videos, and there's also and the Playfair on Campus link. You can see what we do on the colleges and just the kind of...
So you said it's the After Lunch Guy, G-U-Y.
The After Lunch Guy.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Good. All right.
Yeah.
Well, and I know that's such so great. I want you... We're going to be sort of wrapping up the call, but there's a story you shared when I first saw you on stage, and it was... I laughed so... I'm laughing even thinking about it. This whole story about you and the neighbor and cutting the grass and doing that whole thing. I wonder if you could share that story, because I think it would be a great way to wrap this call up. And it's so funny. I don't know if you can remember it. Hopefully you can.
You're laughing and you don't even remember what it was. Exactly. Sure. I will tell that story to an audience of one, since you're going to have to. I see you're hearing it with beginner's mind, so I think I know the story that you're talking about. This was about when my
true story
partner,
though. True, it's a true story though, right?
You know what? Here's what you know how you see these movies and they say based on a true story.
Yeah, I get it. I got it. Yeah. I got it.
That's what I say about this when it's based on a true story. The essence is true. I tell it a little bit differently than it actually happened, because I tell it a little differently every time because I can't exactly remember it myself. But you know, it's a teaching story. It's a story about and when I tell the story, I people say, you know, how do I have more fun in my life? And the answer is the opportunities are always there. You just got to say yes to them. That's really the opportunity. So this is a story that happened when my writing partner Luke Barber and I were working on our book, Work Like Your Dog. And, you know, the 1 second description of that book is like, how many times have you heard somebody say, man, I've been working like a dog and my boss is working me like a dog? But the real question is, you ever take a moment to notice how your dog does spend his day? I mean, where did we ever get that expression from? It'd be your lucky day if you could be working like your dog. And dogs don't seem to know the difference between work and play because everything is new and fresh and exciting to them. And yeah, if we could walk around that way, the world would look exciting to us too. It's what the Buddhists call beginner's mind. You don't come with preconceptions. Things are not boring if you realize this moment has never happened before. Just open your eyes and look around. So anyway, Luke lives in Dallas, Texas, and I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. And so we do most of our collaboration over the internet, but once during the course of every book, we get together and in person, and we do some editing and revising. And so this is when we were working on that book, Work Like Your Dog, and we had one of the principles of Work Like Your Dog is, you know, you need to give yourself lots of breaks so you can renew and revitalize yourself. And we were trying to take our own advice. So Luke is a very master gardener. So we were out working in my vegetable garden. That was, you know, I still now, I have continual battles with gophers. I feel like Bill Murray in that
Groundhog Day.
Yeah, exactly. No, it wasn't Groundhog Day, but it was that golfing movie. I just blanked on the name of it, but, you know. Anyway, so we had just come back from working in the garden, and I could hear the phone ringing in the house. And I was expecting, actually, a phone call from my wife. So I said, look, will you grab the phone and tell Janine I'll be right there. Let me just put the tools back in the tool shed. And Luke, about 20 seconds later, comes to the back door, and he's going like, pick up the phone. Pick up the phone right now. So, you know, I go in the house, I pick up the extension, and immediately I know it's the wrong number. Luke is saying to this woman on the other end, he's saying, okay, my partner's here now. Would you ask him the question you just asked me? And she says to him, she says, you know, I asked you, is this the man who does yards? Well, you know, we had just come in from working in my own yard, and one of the principles of this book was say yes to every opportunity to have fun. Plus, Luke is like shaking his head up and down, like, and sticking his two thumbs up in the air. So I go, well, yeah, this is the man who does yards. And she says, oh, I'm so glad to have found you. She says, I lost touch with my yard man from last year, and my neighbor told me you did a fantastic job on her yard. And I just want to know, what would you charge me to do my yard? And there's like total silence on our end of the phone. And finally, Luke has an inspiration. He says, remind me, what do we charge your friend? And she said, well, you charged her about $35, and my yard's about the same size. And Luke says, $35? Yeah, that sounds about right. And she says, oh, that would be great. She says, well, tell me this. Do you think you could fit me into your busy schedule? And I say to her, okay, that depends on one thing and one thing alone. Where exactly do you live? Well, it turns out she lives like four blocks from our house. So I say, yeah, I think we could fit you into our schedule. She says, oh, that's fantastic. When do you think you can come over? I said, when can we come over? I said, we'll be there in 15 minutes. She says, talk about customer service. I can't believe it. So, you know, we don't know what we're doing. I pop open the trunk of my car. We put the lawnmower in there. We put a couple of rakes in there, a couple of those little hand clippers that I got. And I'm driving over there really carefully so nothing falls out. And turns out she's a really nice woman. She works for American Airlines. She shows us around the yard, which is really a tiny little, no problem at all. So we mow the thing. We rake it up. We're having a good time. We clip the hedges. She gives us $35. We go home. Everybody's feeling pretty good about this thing. The next morning, the phone rings, and it's her again. She tells me we did such a good job, she wants to know, can we take her on as a regular customer for the rest of the summer? Well, it takes Luke about 2 seconds to say, absolutely, you are on our list. You know, of course, he's flying home the next day. It's no skin up of his nose to be saying this, but I figured, look, we went this far with this, we might as well take it the rest of the year, and I mean, rest of the way. And it was absolutely no problem because pretty much when I was going to mow my yard, I scheduled her on the same day. So towards the end of the summer, my next door neighbor, Bob, who's the president of the local bank, he's having a fundraiser over at his place for one of the guys in the bank who's running for city council. And so I get a little bit dressed up. I put a sport jacket on. I go over there. I'm having a couple of drinks. A lot of my friends are there. I'm having a good time. And who should I spot across the living room but my one and only customer? So I'm glad you're enjoying this, David. So very casually, you know, I make my way over to her and we say hello and we have a very nice conversation. We talk about what a nice party is, you know, how great the weather's been. Not once do we say anything about her yard, however. So next morning I'm getting ready to go for a run and I'm stretching against a tree in my own front yard and Bob comes running out of the house. And I say, Bob, thank you so much for inviting me to that party. I had such a good time. He says to me, never mind that. He says, I had a very strange conversation about you with one of my guests. I said, what? He says, well, one of the women from the neighborhood comes over to me and she says, Bob, can you tell me what that man's doing here? And she points over to you. And I say to her, why? Well, what's wrong? Why shouldn't he be here? She says, why shouldn't he be here? He says, that man is my yard man. Bob says, there must be some mistake here. I know that man very well. She says, I'm telling you, that man is my yard man. Bob says, look, I've known this guy for about 10 years. That man is my next door neighbor. She says, that man owns the house next door? She says, I can't believe a yard man could afford a house like that. Bob says, look, I don't know what's going on here, but I do know one thing for certain. That man is not your yard man. 2 weeks later, it's time for my regular appointment. I haven't even gotten out of the car when she is all over me. She says, excuse me. She says, Bob tells me that you're a that you're a management consultant. I say, well, yes, that's true. She says, well, he tells me you're a very successful management consultant. And I say, well, isn't that lovely of him and sweet of him to be saying things like that about me? She says, no, no, he says, I don't understand. Why should a successful management consultant have to have a second job as a yard man? So I pointed out to her when she first called me up, she did not ask if I was a yard man. She asked, was I the man who does yards? Which I most certainly was. First, it was just mine, but now it was both mine and hers. Well, she took a little step back, like she couldn't believe what she was hearing, and then she totally lost it. She was laughing, she was crying, she was bent over double. I was laughing along with her, and then I mowed her lawn. She gave me $35, and I went home. So.
Oh dear. So your books, as we wrap this up, you have books, Managing to Have Fun, Gently Down the Stream, Work Like Your Dog, and Dogs Don't Bite When a Growl Will Do, right? I just wanted to mention those. I just want to say thanks. This has been awesome. I can't wait to have a chat with your wife one day and get you back on the show. And I'm going to see you soon. We're going to be playing together in British Columbia. You're coming up here. We'll get to play together. So I'm really excited about that.
I'm really looking forward to that. And you know, for listeners to your podcast who don't know you in person, you are an awesome player, David. You are so much fun to be around. And I think people really get the sense of that from listening to you here.
All right. Well, thank you. And I really, really appreciate it. We'll see you soon. And yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay, great.
Ciao. I love this story. It's such a cool story, you know, the thing that Bernie couldn't steal, you know, and he really didn't steal it. And, you know, as I've got to know Matt, and, you know, in a 45-minute podcast, it's hard to maybe get the real depth. You get a sense, but, you know, when you chat with a guy like this and you see that deep down in his core, you know, that Bernie wasn't able to steal anything from him. You know, not in the end. They just took money, but they didn't steal the most important things. And, you know, the love that he and his wife share is remarkable. And so, you know, that's a great story for all of us, you know, because I think we all put that sort of that that idea around, you know, once I have this, once I have enough money, I can start living a kick-ass life. Once I pay off this, I can go do that. Once I do this, I can do this. You know, and ultimately, I often think about that last breath of air. You know, you're just about to take in that last suck of air. It's like, this is how I want mine to sound. This is my last breath of air. It's going like this, right? What a rush. That's how I want to go out. And, I think it's way to go, Matt. You know, I love being around him. I love his energy. He is just contagious, you know, and it doesn't matter where you see him, whether you see him on stage or off stage. You know, he just really has that zzz, that yum, that sort of zest for life, that understanding of what really matters, you know. And it was great. It was great to hang out. I'm looking forward to hanging out with him again. And I want to remind you what I said. I want you to practice an accent. If you haven't done an accent yet, and people say, oh, can I do an accent? Of course you can. You can model anything. Pick an accent. And, you know, and the secret, of course, is to exaggerate it a little bit, you know, and do it in a way that is fun, you know. It's like I started with a little Irish accent, and, you know, I think I'll end the call tonight with a little bit of an Irish accent as well. And this is your little friend here, little leprechaun, talking to you all the way from Canada. I don't know. I just woke up in a funny mood today. You know, I told you, it's like this Canada Day thing. You know, we celebrate fireworks, you know, and I want to thank you. I want to thank you for being so cool and really making this thing fly. You know, I really feel this deep sense of responsibility to keep bringing this great product to you. And I got so many great guests lined up. And of course, a lot of these guys I work with, their calendars are so jammed. It's like trying to get them sort of nailed down to a time and a date can sometimes be a little bit difficult because they're on the road a lot. Like my buddy Jack Canfield, he's going to be on there soon. If you haven't seen that, he's on YouTube. You can go to the Kick-Ass Life thing on YouTube, and you can see Jack and John Gray both did a lot of promos for the Kick-Ass Life. It's pretty cool. But he's going to be coming on. And but, you know, like I said, I'm ending this one with a little bit of gratitude for you guys. Thank you so much. And do me a favor. Would you please do me a favor? Would you do me a favor? Maybe you won't do it for that guy over there, but maybe you'll do it for me. Would you mind going on iTunes and giving a review? And giving it a little star rating. Now, there's 5 stars. How many are there? There's 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now, 5 is the number 1 star. That's the best star. All right? So that's the one I'm wanting you to go to. If you think it's any good at all, apart from this crazy, silly accent I'm trying to do right now. All right? So anyway, I think I may be adding a joke session to this soon because I'm, I think, it's always good to have a good joke session. So get out there this time and have some fun. You know, and do good things. Do good things to people. And know that, you know, when crap happens, it doesn't stop anything. The stuff that matters is inside. And a kick-ass life is all about attitude. It's knowing that wherever you go, wherever you show up, things are going to happen. It's going to be cool. And you guys, you know, you can make a difference. So, and I think making a difference, what it's all about. You know, I know that the last breath I take after I go, what a rush, is going to know that hopefully I've made a difference. And so get out there, go and make a difference. Make a difference in someone's life. Knock on your neighbor's door, invite them for dinner, and I'll take them an apple pie, and just reach out. Be nice, be kind. Yep. And we'll be seeing you soon. Look out for our guest next week. Hi, baby. That was kick-ass.